Initiate Kaurad Podcast.
So I'm talking about Calvinism or Arminianism. If it really comes down to this, those are the only two choices, and I'm just going to give my two cents on how I've thought of it up to this point, and basically how I believe, how I think that affects how I live. Again, it seems like a lot of other points where there seems to be two primary camps on the topic, and what seems to be true is a little bit pulled away from each one of them. The whole thing of free will, I guess the main reason I think there is free will in terms of us not being robots, us being able to make a choice, is because of a couple of different things. One of them is the Bible in numerous places tells us to choose various things, which implies that we have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I liken it to a marriage situation where the reason two people in a healthy situation, the reason two people get married is because they both choose each other. And for God, I have to believe he gets more glory from free will agents who have the ability to make a choice, who after being given grace by the Spirit. So I'm going to say I don't believe it's based on the will of man to choose to follow Christ initially to be saved. I believe that purely is the grace of God to grant faith through the Holy Spirit to a person to even think about and believe and come to a place where they decide what they're going to do with the fact that they think that that's real.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to choose to say, I believe you, God, or I don't believe you. It's God doing all the enabling for that to even happen. It has nothing to do with us, but I believe there's a decision point that is up to us, only because I believe he gets more glory. Because at the end, you think about it, at the end, God doesn't have to answer anybody. And again, we'll just say this one more time. God can do whatever he wants. None of this is a matter of, well, God has to do it this way because that wouldn't be fair or whatever. Mm-hmm. That he can do whatever he wants. And at the end, on Judgment Day, and he casts hell into the lake of fire, hell being the place that he originally created for the demons who rebelled against him to begin with. He doesn't need to answer them. He doesn't need to justify himself to them. He doesn't need to do anything. I think that it seems consistent that because he is holy and righteous and follows his own rules, so to speak, that he will prove to them, other than the fact that the scripture says that he took the keys to death and hell from him and made an open spectacle of them. It does say that about the crucifixion, that he made an open spectacle of the demonic, of hell, because we kind of have the pattern in Job where we see Satan accuses Job and God is like, well, you gave him everything he's got. So in other words, you're doing everything for him. Of course he chooses to worship you. God's saying, okay, fine. Take a little bit of it away from him. See what he does. And then again, and again, and again. God didn't have to prove himself to Satan in that picture at all. But you see that pattern. And I believe something similar to that happens or will take place on Judgment Day. It'll be the same thing, whereas those who are granted eternal life as opposed to eternal damnation, you know, at Judgment Day, that he shows, I won't say proves because he doesn't have to prove anything, but same thing with Job, on Judgment Day, that these people chose me. Yes, I enabled them, but there still was a fraction of percentage of a factor of them embracing or not embracing in that moment of grace where I gave them the faith to believe that they chose me, that it's not just all on God. Like, yeah, of course they're all going to make it because he did make everything to make it possible, everything to enable us, everything to lead us to that place. The same kind of thing with Job, that he showed Satan that's like, well, he still chooses to worship me. Same thing in the end with us having exercised our free will in that little fraction of a second to embrace or reject. Then again, compared to marriage, like I was talking about, two people who universally choose each other, that's the kind of relationship God wants from us in terms of he wants us to knowingly, consciously choose him. Again, the whole thing was totally enabled by grace through faith from the Holy Spirit to be able to make that choice. But he wants us to have made that choice. I believe he gets more glory in that scenario. And at the end of time, says these people said yes, I empowered them, but they still made a choice. I think that's more consistent of an understanding of the totality of the Bible and the relationship he wants to have with us, with which is why he gave us a spirit so that we could communicate with him, so that we can partner with him, so to speak, where he involves people. If you look through the whole Bible, it's like God doesn't just do everything. I was thinking about this on the way home from work. It's like Moses, he tells him to put his staff down in the Red Sea when they're up against the Red Sea and Egypt is bearing down on them. Why didn't God just spread the waves? That's what he was going to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yes, that was God's will, was to deliver them. That was his plan to deliver them. Yet his plan wasn't for him to do absolutely every bit of it. Yes, it was his power that made the right. waves and everything go up, but he still required Moses to act in faith based mm-hmm. on what God told him. What do you have in your hand? He's got your staff. Then hit the water. He sticks his staff in the water, and then the way the sea parts. So it's that kind of partnership. I think that's the life he wants for us. If he's doing everything in kind of the extreme Calvinist angle, where it almost becomes like, well, just everything's automatic. Well, mm-hmm. that just doesn't seem consistent with why does he in so many places tell us to choose if it doesn't matter and mm-hmm. if we have no power to choose. But again, disagreeing with the Arminian side of it, it's like that wasn't a human will that came to that place of figuring out to believe and choosing to believe. By grace through faith are you saved. So by grace, faith to a point of responding to that faith. So how does that affect how we live if we believe that that's how things come about? So it matters the choices you make, and to see as you walk through life that you're partnering with God, meaning it's his initiative, it's his plan, it's his power, but you have to walk through it with him. You don't just sit back and you see all this stuff happen, nobody lifting a finger, nobody doing anything. We have to walk with him through it. And like Jesus said, when you go through the waters, you won't be overwhelmed. It's like, but you still have to go through them. Because
mm-hmm.
another aspect you get into, and this is the best discussion I had heard on this topic of so many people get hung up on, why is there evil in the world? If God's good, why is there evil? First of all, evil is not a thing. Evil is an absence of good, or a privation is the word this guy used that I heard. It's a perversion of what's good. It's not a thing. It's right. kind of like cold is not a thing. Cold is the absence of heat.
Right.
So
right.
why is there evil? So the whole thing of the only thing, and to me, the only thing that makes any sense is that there is free will and people make poor choices influenced by the demonic realm and also by the lust of their own flesh, like James talks about. People make choices, they make poor choices, and decades and centuries of poor choices on poor choices on poor choices, and people living in the wake and the consequences of their parents, grandparents, and generations before their poor choices, people making poor choices, so people do bad things. And no, God's not going to interfere, because if he does, then you're complaining, well, then I'm a robot.
Hmm.
The other thing being, if you can't ever choose to do wrong, then how could there be evil? If nobody ever made any wrong choices about anything, how would there be evil?
Mm-hmm.
And then one other factor is, then people would complain, well, why didn't he interfere? Well, which time did you want him to interfere? The time when it only would have been bad for you?
Right.
What about the times when you were sinning against somebody by fornicating with somebody's daughter? That father would have wanted God to interfere in that situation so
right.
that he didn't sin against God and take something away from his daughter. So who gets their way?
Right.
You know, so if you get God interfering in one sense that there is no free will, well, pick which situations you want him to interfere in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why pray? To me, it's not the power of us praying. It's us are on this earth. We were given to steward the earth. So we're partnering with God. We're agreeing with God. And not that our agreement is so powerful. It's God's power, but we're saying, yes, God, we want you to do what you wanted to do to begin with. We want you to restore our nation. We want you to bring your kingdom to this earth. We agree with you as the stewards that you set up of this planet. We agree with you. He wants that relationship. He wants to interact with us as part of all of his plan.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always his power. It's always his initiative. It's always his plan that makes any of it possible.
Right. One thing that you said that I've always heard that answer, like, why is there evil? Because God allows us to choose good or evil. And if he didn't, we'd all be robots. And I always thought, oh, that's a perfect answer. Boom. But then I heard somebody recently say, and it's not like this is a contradictory answer. It's just another answer that goes along with it. If God didn't exist, there's no such thing as good or evil.
Right.
I know if there's, I heard a little snippet, I think it was, of a debate between atheist and a Christian. And the question of the debate was, can morality exist without God?
Yeah, right.
No. How? How could it possibly?
There's no point of reference.
What is morality?
Right, exactly.
Who decides what's right? If everyone decides what's right for themselves, that's not real morality.
Exactly.
That's just preference.
Yes.
And if the Nazis are in control,
right,
and they could, then they get to decide what's moral and what's not. How can we judge them?
Right.
Like, anyway, I thought that was a great answer. How can God exist if there's evil? Well, evil can't exist if there is no God, because good can't exist if there's no God.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to comment on, you said, you know, God doesn't interfere. I think if God took his hands completely, and I know is not what you meant.
Yeah,
if he decided, like, all right, I'm just going to take my hands completely out of this, we would all be murdering and raping each other in an instant. we would all be dead.
It's the grace of God. I always struggled with the idea of people at funerals, at eulogies, where they would say something good about somebody. I mean, I went through this with my father-in-law. That's when it struck me, and during my father-in-law's funeral, just during COVID, so I ended up doing it outdoor at their place. I finally came to terms with it. It's like, you know what? Anything good that you see in somebody is actually the grace of God at work.
Right.
If you see any good. And, you know, as far as the total depravity on the Calvinist side, I guess if we're born spiritually dead, then yeah, I guess that, you know, we were talking earlier before we started officially, and I wish I knew the guy's name, that would have been helpful reference, but that Pat, our senior leader, was referring to about that when it says that when Adam, in the day he ate the fruit, that he died. It's like, well, obviously he didn't physically die until hundreds of years later. He spiritually died. So could somebody who's spiritually dead do anything good? And it's like, well, only by the grace of God. That's the goodness of God at work. So the idea of at a funeral saying something good about somebody, you know, if it is indeed true, it's like, it's not wrong to say that and acknowledge that there was, that the grace of God manifest in somebody's life in how they lived, you know, when they did something quote unquote good.
Yeah.
But on the, if God's good, why is there evil? So just finish that off. The idea that you can't have it both ways, basically. If you want free will, and yes, it's typically free will that's at fault when things go bad, and yet the devil gets in there and wreaks havoc, but largely because of human choice, you either have choice to be able to choose wrong or right, or you have no choice at all. Again, which situations want God to interfere on? Just the ones that would affect you negatively, you know?
Right,
but
yeah, exactly.
You still want to do what you want to do. You want to sin with this person or steal this money or do whatever. What about the guy on the other side of that equation? He would want God to interfere so that you don't take his stuff. So, you know, you either have choice or you don't. And if you have choice, then you have the possibility to choose wrongly, choose poorly. And decades and centuries of that over the course of humanity, you're going to end up where we see ourselves, which is, and you see this generational thing, and some of it you can say is specifically spiritual generational, but some of it is also just flat out how they lived, how they were taught, and that just continued to perpetuate.
So I just wanted to share a story from my experience being a dad. So Danny Silk, our church went through some classes with him a while back, and his kind of big thing was, so he talked about parenting, but then he would also talk about, like, you could apply this to any relationship with any person, boss, parent, sibling, friends, whatever. And he was saying there's kind of a way that humans have tended to look at relationships since the beginning of time, especially in a, like, a parent, child, boss, employee type of thing, leader, follower, is that someone is going to be dominant and the other person is going to be dominated. That's not his words, but that's kind of how I... quick way to say it. He would always, in his seminars, he would show this picture of a red truck and a yellow truck. And it was this, like, humongous piece of construction equipment with tires that are, like, almost as big as a house. And it rolled over a red pickup truck. And so this red pickup truck was, like, absolutely smashed. by this yellow truck. And he said, this is how people see relationships. Like, you're either the yellow truck or the red truck. Either you're on top and you're in charge and everyone is just under you and they have to do what you say, or you're the guy on the bottom and you're being told what to do and you don't get any choices in life and you have no power in the relationship. So his thing was, every person in a relationship, or each person, each side, has power to affect the relationship and affect the other person. And if you don't admit that and face that truth, and you just want to be like, well, I'm the dad, so I'm in charge, so I just get to make my son do whatever I want, and he has to obey, and he has no power in this relationship, I have all the power, then it's going to be tough, and it's going to be a rough ride for both father and son. So the kind of his approach is like, not only do you look at your son and think to yourself, like, he does have power in this relationship. He can affect the relationship and affect me. But go so far as to tell him that. Because if you've been doing it, the red truck, yellow truck way, in his mind, like, well, I can't wait till I get to dominate my kids or other people. Right. Someday I'll be big enough. But now I'm just an underling and I get crushed and I can only get away with it if he's not looking or whatever. Not saying that you shouldn't discipline and you shouldn't enforce what you tell your kids. That's not the point. So there's a couple of phrases that I have. One is like, so you both have power in the relationship. You and the two-year-old can affect you and affect the relationship. And you can't stop it. You don't have so much power that you can not let a two-year-old affect you. Just because you're bigger and you're technically in charge and God's given you authority over this child doesn't mean the child can have no effect on you. I'm not going to tell you what to do or what you will do. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And then you have to decide what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard parents say this. Kid says, I don't want to do it. And the parent says, well, you're going to do it.
Right, right.
Like, do you have a crystal ball? there's no possible way he could choose not to do it. Because sometimes you discipline a kid and then he still doesn't do it.
Right, right.
But this is like offense of like, this child is disobeying and I'm mad and it's correct. Children obey your parents.
Right.
Parents should keep their children under control. But this, like, when you get furious and you get offended and you say, well, you're going to do it. I don't care what you say. What Danny Silk says is how you should treat other people. You say, I don't know what you're going to do.
Yep.
I know what I'm going to do. And that can include, enforcing consequences. I'm going to ground you, give you a paddling, whatever.
Yep. Like,
this is what I'm going to do. This is what I hope you're going to do. But I don't know what you're going to do. That's up to you. And that just kind of breaks this, like, I'm all powerful and you're nothing in this relationship. If I'm explaining that well enough, I feel like I'm not finishing the sentence.
You're going to tell the story again to give the example of that?
Yes, yes. During this like class that we were taking and learning all this stuff, my son, he was potty training. Potty training went longer than we were wanting it to. So we would send the kids to bed and he would say, you got to go use the toilet before you go to bed every time. But then while he was in there, rule we had was you can't have a drink of water before you get in bed because then we're going to have to change the sheets in an hour. So we were trying to avoid having to change the sheets. But then I would notice, like, and I don't know if it was just rebellion or he loved water, like the Bible says, stolen water is sweet. Maybe that's what it was. He would go use the toilet, wash his hands, and then take like a sip of water out of the bathroom faucet. He would come out and his face was wet. I was like, what are you, like, how do I, do I need to, like, come in there with you and watch you every second of the day and make sure? And again, if you get this mindset, like, you're going to absolutely make sure your kids never disobey, well, then you're going to have to follow them around 24/7 and watch every move. And, like, maybe you're going to have to crack their head open and look at their thoughts, too, to try to, maybe they're... then you turn into like this dictator where you get the thought police and you gotta watch every move and be paranoid that maybe somebody is planning on trying to disobey and we gotta stop. So I had this concept of, I can't control my kids. I can't make them do everything right. I can tell them what to do and I can enforce it to a certain extent.
Right.
And he was explaining, you just admit it out loud, say you have power in this relationship and you can affect it and I hope you do it in a way that's good for both of us, but I can't make you. I can put parameters and I can bring consequences, but ultimately you're going to have to decide what you're going to do. And so I did this with him and I said, and we'd already talked about it, like, you can't take a drink of water while you're in the bathroom. And he kept doing it and said, all right, go use the bathroom. But before you do, I just want to tell you something or talk about this for a minute. And I got like down to his eye level and I said, you have the power to break trust and I can't stop you. And I said, hold out your hands, cup your hands and hold them out like I was going to give him something. And I cupped my hands as if I was holding something and I was going real careful, like it was fragile. And I was like going through the motions of putting something in his hands. I wasn't holding anything. And I said, this is my trust. I'm giving you my trust. I've told you you're not allowed to take a drink of water before bed. And you know why. And I'm not going to follow you into the bathroom, but I'm going to just give you my trust that you're going to obey and do what you're supposed to. But I can't make you do it. And if you're going to break this trust, then you're going to do it. And there's nothing I can. And his eyes were just wide, like, oh my goodness, this is, I need to be careful with this.
Yep.
And he was just all like, oh my goodness, this is heavy. This is important stuff. And I said, so go to the bathroom and just please be careful with this trust that I'm giving you. If you break it, I'm not sure at what point we'll get it back. And so he went in. I couldn't resist putting my ear to the door. You know, heard him using the toilet, flush, washed his hands for 5 seconds, whatever. And he came out with a big smile on his face. His face was dry. And I was like, getting mad at him, screaming at him wasn't working. You know, punishment doesn't necessarily work. Sometimes you don't notice that he'd got away with it even, you know.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying don't discipline your kids. Don't enforce the rules. But that's not everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. There's other ways to involve them.
Yeah. Not just involve them, but even while you discipline and enforce rules, the concept is still true. They are going to do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's now or after they get out of the house.
Yeah. Right.
Or when you're not looking, or when they're out with their friends and you're not with them. At some point, you have to build this relationship and say, like, I want to trust you. I want you. But I can't stop you.
Right.
You have to take care of yourself. And I remember a friend of mine put it to me when he was helping me go through some stuff that I was needing accountability with and whatever. And he said, I can't do this for you. You have the power to continue to do what you know isn't right. And you have the power to wreck your life. And I can't stop you. I'm here to help you in any way that I can. But I can't do this for you. You have to do it. Same kind of concept, you know. And that, when he said that to me, that just hit me like, oh my gosh, I have the power to wreck my life. And he can't stop me, and God won't necessarily stop me.
Right.
God's let other people completely shipwreck and die and go to hell.
Yeah.
Or utterly fail and wreck their family. You know, there might be redemption later, but I don't want to go through that.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that's a cool concept that. And Danny Silk, he's a Christian, and I'm trying to think, connect this some way with, I don't remember a lot of Bible verses or teaching from this guy, but I'm sure there was. I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't
yeah.
think of any. But just this concept of like saying, like, forget this red truck, yellow truck thing. Like, your goal isn't to just be on top and everyone else be beneath you, and you have all the power and everybody else has none
yeah.
in life. Not that we're all going hard after that, but...
Right.
In certain areas of life, like parenting, we tend to think that if we're going to have good kids, we're going to like make them obey all the time. And
right, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's not necessarily that way.
Not that powerful. And if you really actually are, they're probably quite crushed and broken.
Right, right.
Yeah, and like you said, it's not that the thing, and I think that's missing more and more and more in generation after generation, that's just continue to slide and... Now we're at a place, and I'm sure they said this generations ago, but it has continued to decline, and that is that there are consequences for your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole issue of training children is true freedom isn't the ability to just do whatever you want. I mean, a lot of people, if you ask them what freedom is, it's like, I can just do whatever I want. Freedom is the ability to choose to do good or to not do good, but it's not the idea that everybody can just go crazy. So children have to be taught that there are consequences of their actions and to be taught how to choose to do what is healthy and right, and ideally in a Christian context, to do what is godly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not this idea of that you can just do whatever you want. And that's so pervasive these days. But to train a child to realize there are consequences for what you do. There are natural consequences for things you do. There's like one of the laws of physics, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Hmm. So when you do evil to someone, there is a response to that. So we want to train them that they understand that there are limits to things. And you can see it with kids where they do the most ridiculous things and they just, it's not just curiosity. They have to understand that at some point you have to regulate your actions because mm-hmm. they're either not healthy, they're not physically healthy, they're not healthy for somebody else. It's just not a free-for-all. I likened it to when you bring reinforcement of consequences to a child, it's like they're driving along on the freeway of life and they're going a billion miles an hour and they go around a corner because I can just do whatever I want to do. Laws of physics say, no, you can't. And they go flying off the side of the road, or worse, they're in a mountain. They go around a curve. I want to go 80 miles an hour, and they go around a curve that's only safe up to about 20. And mm-hmm. they go flying off a mountain and crash. Enforcing consequences is the guardrail as you go around that corner to go, oh, okay, I'm beyond what's safe or healthy or right mm-hmm. in what I'm doing. I need to adjust my behavior.
Right.
And the idea of parenting is that you hopefully give them a healthy picture, which is to say it's not oppressive. It's not so restricting that they don't ever think they can do anything, but they understand that they have the ability to choose and it makes a difference what they choose, and to train them how to choose things that are healthy and right. And that guardrail of life, they bump into it and realize, okay, I've hit the limit of what is safe or healthy or right. So one of the big arguments from, I don't even know if I want to classify them. I don't want to use such generic words to classify people that they would propose that you basically, oh, you're stifling children's creativity if you limit them in any way. How absolutely, utterly absurd that is.
Right.
That when you do present consequences in situations when the child's trying to go beyond what's healthy, right, or safe, in that there's actually a peace that kids have when they know that there's a limit, when they know that there's guardrails in their lives. Whereas if they think they can just do anything, that actually causes an unsettling in them because they have no idea where the limit is.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I've seen kids where they, especially in regards to other people's stuff. Now, stuff isn't more important than people, but stuff is an extension of its owner. And so, for instance, when I was a kid going into a hi-fi shop, which I started doing when I was, you know, I don't know, probably 12 or whatever, is the saying was, touch with your eyes.
Right.
And you see kids that obviously haven't been taught that. You're not crushing anything by telling them this is somebody else's thing and it's not okay for you to do anything and everything with it since you don't even know how to use it or what it is. You need to understand that there is a process involved in being approved and learning and being improved and being empowered to use somebody's thing or this object, that just exploring just freely and having your way with something,
right.
It's not a benefit and it might be detrimental. And again, if it's not your item, whatever it is, it's an extension of the person whose it is. You're disregarding them by disregarding their stuff. Again, stuff isn't more important than people, but it is an extension of them. So there's a point where they have to be taught how to behave around other people's stuff, especially stuff that they don't have the understanding of what actually to do with it or how to use it.
That reminds me, talking about people's stuff. When I was a kid, my dad really believed in, yes, we should share and we should give to others and let people play with our toys, but there's still such a thing as property rights. It's not sharing if an adult takes it away from you and gives it to somebody else.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Or tells you you're required to share. It's not really sharing. So what he would do, somebody's yelling, that's my toy, give it back, whatever. He would come in the room and he would say, okay, quiet, stop. Who does it belong to? And child A is holding it. And they're like, and child B is like, it's mine. Okay, child A, who does it belong to? He's like, him, like, give it back. Well, it's my turn. He had it too long. Give it back. It's not yours. And then give it back. He's like, okay, now, why don't you want to share? Let's talk about it, whatever, you know. So that reminds me, though, of when our daughter was one or two, somewhere in there, years old. we went to a friend's house, and they have several kids right about her age and older. And say they had all these toys, and since we went to their house, all the toys were there. She brought a teddy bear with her, and that's all she brought. And she loved this teddy bear, and she would always have it with her at that time in her life. And she set the teddy bear down and went to go play with another toy. And one of the other kids went and picked up her teddy bear, and she freaked out. Like, yeah. That's mine! Just, no! Give it back! Just, like, went crazy. Uh-huh. They were like, whoa, what's going on? That's mine! And the other kid's just like, what did I do? I just picked up a toy. Anyway, and so we sat her down, and it's like, if you want to play with their toys, you need to share yours.
Yeah.
We are not going to allow you to play with their toys. Well, they said it could. I know. We're going to put this limit. You can't play with their toys until you learn to share your toys.
Yep.
They're going to share, you know.
Because you're asking them to share theirs.
Right. Yeah. She's like, man, just hug the teddy bear even tighter. Like, I'm not giving this thing up. And like, it's up to you. We're not making you share. We're not forcing you to. It's your stuff. And we went back to talk and whatever. And two or three times she would like try to play with the toy. Like, no, are you going to share your teddy bear? No. Uh-huh. Like, okay, then put that other toy down.
Yeah.
We were talking. All of a sudden, like, she was finally got the idea. Like, she's not going to get away with continuing to grab the other toys if she's not going to share. She was just sitting there, just angry, not knowing what to do, clutching her teddy bear, and then looking at this other toy across the room. And finally, she just couldn't take it anymore. She just runs across the room, whips her teddy bear at the kid sitting next to the toy, and grabbed the toy and ran off.
Hostile takeover.
Yeah, right.
Nice. Like,
I guess that's sharing. I don't know.
Yeah. At least it was an exchange.
Right. We all thought that was pretty funny.
That is good.
Another story that reminds me of involving the same kids. The neighbor kid was over playing in their yard, and all of a sudden I heard my daughter and this other kid screaming at each other, and I went out, and the other kid was sitting on our daughter's bike, and she's like, get off my bike! Get off my bike! And he's like, you're being selfish! He was sitting on her bike, and he's screaming at her, you're being selfish! And I went to the kid and I said, you need to get off that bike. It doesn't belong to you. Give it back to her. He's like, but she needs to learn to share.
No, that's not up to you to negotiate right. That.
Like, you are correct. That's not your job, though.
Yeah, correct. Right. Yes, exerting the ever-logical approach. Yes, I'm sure I know who we're talking about. But yeah.
And that kind of brings up, kind of don't we all... We want to enforce the morality on everyone else while we're in the midst of not obeying ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jesus said, or no, Paul, you who say don't steal, do you steal? You who
right.
say...
Exactly.
And that kind of comes back around to what we were talking about before. C.S. Lewis, I think it was his book, Mere Christianity. I can't remember. He was talking about how do we know there is a moral law? Everybody seems to agree there is morality. And he said, well, kind of a, if you look around, you can kind of see it that, yes, there is morality and people will appeal to the moral law just naturally. And he said, like, for example, somebody gets on a bus and they see a seat that they usually sit in, say, or something. I can't remember the exact analogy, but it's something like this. They say, well, please move. I want to sit there.
Yeah.
And the other person, to defend them, so they say, no, I'm not going to move. People don't normally say, because I could give a crap about you. I don't care about anything. They find a moral law that backs what they want.
Yeah.
And they appeal to that. Like, well, I was here first.
Yeah.
Like, first come, first serve, or whatever. Like, that's some kind of moral law that, well, the other person's like, yes, but my feet hurt, you know, whatever. And like, everybody's trying to pull, you know, like, you need to be kind to me because of this, you know. Nobody just says, I hate you, I don't care about you.
Yeah,
that might
right.
be how they truly feel, but
yeah, right.
everybody wants to appeal to the moral law
yeah.
automatically to defend their position.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows there is one.
Right.
They're not necessarily applying it correctly in this case, but
yep. We're talking about parenting and raising children and stuff, and a lot of times when you're in the middle of it, it can be hard to keep your bearing on, okay, what is really the higher objective of what I'm trying to do here by raising my child? And one aspect of the fact that you're actually trying to guide your child, you're trying to train them in a specific way, whatever it might be, is a fruit at the end of that when they are adults on their own that you can have a healthy relationship with them. Then they can be your friend and you're more like a confidant or an advisor. You're no longer the guardian. You're no longer molding and shaping them by how you interact with them. Now you're an advisor to them. And if you raise them in a adversarial type of relationship, it's hard to have a healthy adult relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
But also the fruit of when you have raised them and no one's perfect, we know there's always going to be on one side or the other, you're going to end up leaning one way or the other in some situation. Those things aside, because everybody's going to have them, if you've done a more healthy than not job with them, you're going to enjoy hanging around with them as adults. They're going to be people that are enjoyable to be around. That's part of it, is the kids that you see that they're really not trained. They're atrocious adults.
Right.
If they're not in jail. I mean, because if they haven't learned that there are rules and they are enforced, to like Tim West's dad talking about that moment when they saw this kid not responding to his dad, Tim's dad pointed out that if he doesn't learn to respond to his parent and obey them, then the next level is going to be a teacher. And if he isn't learned to obey them later in life, it's going to be the police. And if he can't obey them, then it's going to be the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge is going to have the power to imprison them for their actions.
Right.
If they can't get the idea that they can't just do whatever they want, because it's not for the greater good of the entire society. I don't even want to say greater good, but the fact is it's not healthy. It's not going to build up society. It's going to tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
And if the judge sends them to prison, their choices have taken them there because they had a lot of opportunities before that at younger ages and at less severe situations to choose to obey, to choose to realize it's healthier and safer and more productive to choose to follow the rule than it is to just do whatever it is they think they want to do.
Right.
So some of the most pleasant and healthy young adults you'll meet are those who have been trained and brought up by parents who established rules and guidelines and things for them and enforced them. So the fruit, the harvest of training children to understand that there are limits to things that are healthy, safe, productive, whatever, that you can't just do whatever you want, is how they behave and they become enjoyable adults to be around. They're not clones. They're not robots. They make their own choices, but they've been taught a better way to live and taught how to make choices to live that way, to be healthy. They're enjoyable to be around. They're very pleasant to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell them, I'm not going to say that this is automatic with homeschooling, but a good example is you will encounter a fair number of homeschooled children that are very pleasant young adults. And again, they're not robots, they're not clones. They don't just say exactly what their parents would say, but they're considerate, they're engaging, they're enjoyable to be around.
Right, yeah. And yeah, that's definitely true. You can't say that all homeschoolers are great, and you can't also say that, you know, all non-homeschoolers are terrible. Whatever, I agree with that.
Exactly.
But same exact point you were making. We homeschooled our kids, but we sent them to a few classes at one point to the local high school, and our son came home. It was like a shop-type class, I think, or mechanics or something like that. And so they're dealing with tools and other stuff and whatever, taking things apart and putting them together. And he came home one day, and he said that he stayed after class to help put stuff away, and he said the teacher said, it's like, you know, I got a couple other homeschoolers in this class, and all you homeschoolers are always just so helpful. Nobody else wants to help.
Right.
Clean up when we're done. Again, that's anecdotal, whatever. But
right.
I took it as, okay, maybe we're doing something right here.
Exactly. Exactly. When that's really the fruit of things is when the average Joe on the street notices something different.
Mm.
In a positive way about your child or you or whatever, that bears witness the fact that you've obviously done something different than what other people are doing that seems to be producing a good result.
Yeah. Yeah, if it stands out enough that somebody notices and says something, then presumably it's not the norm that this person is typically seeing.
and they know that it's good. They know that it contributes good and health to society.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were saying specifically about homeschoolers. I think that it's more than like just my kid stayed home instead of went to school, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think I'll just say it, that Christians tend to be more likely to homeschool in my experience.
Yeah.
And again, not saying that all Christians raise their kids perfectly, but I think we're following a book that's given us the correct advice and pattern for how to raise kids.
Yeah. So let me encourage those of you who maybe are wondering, has it been worth all the effort you've been trying to homeschool? You've been trying to guide your children and people around you maybe discourage you to keep fighting the fight, that it is worth, they're going to be taught something. They're going to be trained how to live some way. It's just a question of, are you going to be the active ingredient in that? And are you going to seek the advice of others who obviously have a healthy family life to help you in the areas where you're just not sure exactly what to do with it, but you're going to persist. You're going to fight the fight because the outcome is worthwhile. And I want to challenge those who think that that's ridiculous. I'm just going to tell you that you are training your children to live in some way. Is that a healthy way? Is really how you're raising them, is that really going to produce a healthy adult that's productive, that contributes to society, that brings society up and not just consume and pull down society and people around them? It's up to you how you're going to train them. Train them in a way that brings life.